A reading from 1 Kings chapter 3, verses 4 through 28. The king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was the principal high place. Solomon used to offer 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, "Ask what I should give you." And Solomon said, "You have shown great and steadfast love to your servant, my father David, because he walked before you in faithfulness, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart toward you. And you have kept for him this great and steadfast love, and have given him a son to sit on his throne today. And now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of my father David. Although I am only a little child, I do not know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of the people whom you have chosen, a great people, so numerous they cannot be numbered or counted. Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, able to discern between good and evil, for who can govern this your great people?" It pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this. God said to him, "Because you have asked this, and have not asked for yourself long life or riches, or for the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern what is right, I now do according to your word. Indeed, I give you a wise and discerning mind. No one like you has been before you, and no one like you shall arise after you. I give you also what you have not asked, both riches and honor all your life. No other king shall compare with you. If you will walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and my commandments as your father David walked, then I will lengthen your life." Then Solomon awoke. It had been a dream. He came to Jerusalem, where he stood before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. He offered up burnt offerings and offerings of well-being, and provided a feast for all his servants. Later, two women who were prostitutes came to the king and stood before him. The one woman said, "Please, my lord, this woman and I live in the same house, and I gave birth while she was in the house. Then on the third day after I gave birth, this woman also gave birth. We were together. There was no one else with us in the house. Only the two of us were in the house. Then this woman's son died in the night because she lay on him. She got up in the middle of the night and took my son from beside me while your servant slept. She laid him at her breast and laid her dead son at my breast. When I rose in the morning to nurse my son, I saw that he was dead. But when I looked at him closely in the morning, clearly it was not the son I had born." But the other woman said, "No, the living son is mine, and the dead son is yours." The first said, "No, the dead son is yours, and the living son is mine." So they argued before the king. Then the king said, "The one says, 'This is my son that is alive, and your son is dead,' while the other says, 'Not so, your son is dead, and my son is the living one.' So the king said, 'Bring me a sword.' And they brought a sword before the king. The king said, 'Divide the living boy in two, then give half to the one and half to the other.' But the woman whose son was alive said to the king, because compassion for her son burned within her, 'Please, my lord, give her the living boy. Certainly do not kill him.' The other said, 'It shall be neither mine nor yours. Divide it.' Then the king responded, 'Give the first woman the living boy. Do not kill him. She is his mother.' All Israel heard of the judgment that the king had rendered, and they stood in awe of the king, because they perceived that the wisdom of God was in him to execute justice." Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Thanks be to God.
Each week when folks gather for our Tuesday morning Bible study, we bring together different versions of the Bible. It's illuminating to see how the same Hebrew or Greek words are interpreted by various translators at different times. This week we noticed a particularly sharp difference in translations of what Solomon asks for in his dream, according to verse 9. Should we understand Solomon's request of God as an understanding mind, a discerning heart, or a God-listening heart, as the different translations have put it? Which translation is closest to the truth here, and what's at stake in the choice? It seems like the key distinction to be made is between mind and heart. The mind is the place of facts and figures, of information that can be learned in schools and measured on tests. The heart includes this sort of data, but also adds to it a more comprehensive sense of ethics and of character. The heart, which the biblical tradition teaches as the place of the soul, encompasses a personality, communicates compassion, and makes one human. The heart. Seen in this light, Solomon's request is not simply for knowledge, but is rather for a more complete wisdom, situated as it is in the heart. Information and knowledge, rightly ordered, are necessary but insufficient subsets of wisdom, as though they were the smaller dolls inside a set of Russian nesting dolls. You know the ones I'm talking about? Information is a subset of knowledge. And knowledge is a subset of wisdom, which is the holistic way of holding together both mind and heart in one. Now, Solomon, we heard, asks for wisdom from God in the early years of his reign, which has not been marked by divine wisdom to this point. Let me tell you what I mean. Solomon is the child of David and Bathsheba, whom we heard about last Sunday. And he's the chosen successor to both the throne and the grievances of his father David. The fracturing of righteousness in ancient Israel's civil society comes about because of David's unjust conquest of Bathsheba, and it continues far beyond David's life. On his deathbed, David instructs Solomon to kill a number of political rivals. Solomon's first actions as king are to go down this hit list, deploying the sword against his brother Adonijah, then against Joab and Abiathar and others, thereby consolidating his reign. This was, and in some ways still is, commonplace among rulers, using unrighteous commands and the permission of violence to secure power. Deploying dominance and gaining victory over enemies is a well-worn path to those other conventional goals we've heard of, long life and wealth. But this path leads to violence and war rather than peace. Subsequent battles we hear about lead Solomon to attempt truces through intermarriages, which open the door to worship of other gods. This is the foolishness of Solomon's first actions as king, his attempts at following the norms of behavior for people in power. Now, a cynic would point out that in the time of his dream encounter with God, Solomon doesn't need to ask God for long life or riches or victory over his enemies because he's sought after those things already. He's tried other avenues, tried and true methods, to live by the conventional wisdom of his day and ours. Wisdom which has been summarized by another as might makes right, power is superior to compassion, despair is stronger than hope, money is God, and the one who dies with the most toys wins. Such is the conventional wisdom. But Solomon sees that that sort of knowledge alone, that apparent knowledge, is bankrupt, like chasing after wind. The only thing left, the heart of wisdom that Solomon asks God for, is the ability, in his words, to discern between good and evil. This is not mere knowledge, according to the ways of the world, but rather is understanding to do what is right, as God tells him. Even though wisdom is uncharacteristic to the Solomon we've seen in the biblical story so far, God comes to him, and God equips him with wisdom. Wisdom, we're told, to execute justice. In response, Solomon lays aside conventional understandings and begins to enact this divine wisdom for justice. The next things we see from Solomon give glimpses of what God's wisdom looks like. Solomon's immediate reply to this God moment is to sacrifice and to provide a feast for all his servants. Which is to say, Solomon shows his regard and his gratitude for God with the sacrifice, and his regard and gratitude for human beings by providing a feast, including especially those whose servant labor helps him every day as king. God's wisdom seeks to maintain right relationships with justice and faith and compassion, loving God and loving neighbor as oneself. Solomon then demonstrates this wisdom as he adjudicates this legendary dispute between these two women. Faced with an impossible she said situation where there are no other witnesses and a child's life is at stake, Solomon finds a way where there seems to be no way. Calling for a sword, the same sword, mind you, that was once deployed to off political rivals, calling for that sword, Solomon creates a moment where the child's true mother comes to light. God's wisdom uses the sword not for vengeance or dominating power, but instead for the revealing of truth and for the protection of the weak. Consider swords today, beloveds. Consider the swords. We've survived a week marked by violence and division and condemnation of the other, perpetuated in the names of white supremacy and of Christian domination against the Jews. We've seen mail bombs create domestic terrorism in the service of political ideology. A white man targeting and killing black people at a Kroger's grocery store in Kentucky. And the slaughter of 11 Jews as they gathered for worship yesterday morning in Pittsburgh. These are only the latest in a series of high-profile events in a season of growing racial violence and anti-Semitism, which has gone up significantly in recent years. This is where we find ourselves. Chants of "the Jews will not replace us" by white supremacists in Charlottesville a year ago have spread in examples of violent speech and action too numerous to count. Consider the swords. These are examples of the dark arts of political psychology, deploying divisive rhetoric and attack ad smears to depress electoral participation, to tear down opponents, and to win no matter what the cost or the consequences. These are the ways of worldly practice and belief, pursuing the long life of partisan rule, pursuing the riches gained through unjust policies, pursuing victory over political enemies. From a congressional baseball game to worshipers at synagogues and churches, the consequences of this bigoted feuding continue to grow more deadly by each week. consider the swords. And so much for conventional wisdom. By contrast, over and against these weapons of division, God equips Solomon and us as successors in the biblical tradition with protective, discerning, and faithful wisdom to do otherwise. This is the wisdom that Solomon receives and passes on to us by his better examples, the wisdom we're told to execute justice. God calls us, as people of faith, to a higher level, to a more transcendent practice of Christ-like faith, faith that welcomes the stranger, acts with mercy, and forgives, even in the face of enemies. This religious ethic is shared among people of faith across various traditions. It is not Christian alone. In fact, writer Barry Weiss points out the heartbreaking coincidence is that the Jewish emphasis on the open door, on welcoming the stranger, is exactly what the Jews of Tree of Life Synagogue and the Jews of every synagogue, big and small, in every far-flung corner of the globe were reading about yesterday on Shabbat morning, opening the door to the stranger and welcoming the foreigner. That religious ethic at the heart of their tradition and ours is the wisdom of God for people of faith at times like this. Now, to be sure, just because we have the wisdom doesn't necessarily mean that we will follow the better angels of our nature and use it. Solomon, after all, piled one indignity upon another, failing to exercise in the rest of his life the wisdom that God gives him. For us, will we now exercise the justice and wisdom to enact justice? Will we choose through our leaders to enact justice? Will we approach the election of this season and our votes as opportunities to enact justice, or will we foolishly indulge the passing fads that masquerade as wisdom in the world today? How will we put the swords of white privilege and Christian domination to different use? How will we subvert or undo some of the generational accumulation of misbegotten gains and give those to new uses today? These are the challenges that we wrestle with and that we are called to lean into for the sake of God's compassionate, protective, and hopeful wisdom. How will we resist the accumulation of violence in our city streets, in domestic abuse cases, and even in places of worship? That's what we're called to as people of faith. God's alternative is this kind of wisdom to execute justice. In the words of writer Paul Rauschenbusch, this is a time for people of all faiths to come together, reject the hate and work instead for the future of our nation, where there is no supremacy by any one group, and all are welcome, there is equity for all, and where the tree of life bears fruit for all. May God help us make it so. Amen.